Blog Talk Radio.
Masonic Companion. Yes, you've found us. It's a pleasure to have you back. I hope that you've put your clocks forward. We're really talking in the middle of the night. It's the start of, we're approaching the equinox, aren't we? Spring is just coming on the 20th. This is the, after all, the 67th day of the year. And we're inclined to start to think of the world, the weather, and the climate as being a cup half full. We're speaking to you from Canada, where oh my goodness, we have winter. We have winter. We have we enjoy the four seasons because we are always looking forward to what's coming next. It's a period of change, and it keeps us in the back of our minds. It reminds us that everything changes. I'm going to challenge that a little bit today, as usual. I've come up with some notions that perhaps time doesn't change. We're going to look at that a bit and see what plays out here. Does time change or does it remain the same? And I'm thinking about time in the sense that the physicists are plugging away. Today, the topic, I was in such, I know this only happens to me, never happens to right-minded fellows like you, men and women out there, but I was in such a bleak frame of mind, such is the nature of masonry. You don't have to walk around with a bobblehead. Everything's wonderful. It's just over the top and exciting. Well, sometimes it's plausible that we just don't get it. So for a group, a fraternal order, hundreds of years old, we that espouses this, we can now say in the 21st century, it's wonderfully liberating to be able to look at ideas that were closeted in the past, examine them, hold them up for examination from different perspectives. The good, the bad, and the ugly. We're taught very early on to sand away the varnish, the polish. Think beyond what other people want a man to think. And then we're able to, and we're encouraged to make our own determinations, make our own decisions, think for ourselves. That said, the Freemasonry espouses a confidence. It doesn't say, thou shalt, you do this, doesn't have cannons. What it does is encourages an ethical existence. Well, a sense of ethics is not a black and white world. It's understanding, taking the ingredients into account at the time and making the right choices, the right decisions. So that does that change from time to time? Hopefully it does, because no man is ever the same every single day. The world changes around us. Our children grow. We get a little wiser, not older, but wiser. And trees fall in the forest. That said, we have is it compelling to think about ourselves in the context of this liberal this opportunity for liberal engagement? I don't fault you for thinking that. It's not necessarily an easy transaction to find yourself in and find answers, but really, we came to the door of the lodge, submitting. We submitted. We are asked whether we trust what we're about to get into without necessarily knowing, even if some loose tongue person mistaking it for friendship discloses some of what's going to happen. It doesn't prepare the mind for the experience. Nothing can really do that. We can talk about it, but when you actually go through it, you know that you add a sensation, an emotional and intellectual reaction that wasn't there before. Can people understand that point without having gone through it? Well, you're really slicing experience with a scalpel, aren't you? Saying, nobody knows what I'm going through. Well, that's a different topic entirely. That's like saying, I'm the only one that goes through emotional, intellectual experiences. I'm the only one that experiences novelty. I'm the only one moved by certain things. Come on now, that's not nice. Our parents, that would be embarrassing to our parents if we were walking around saying that, you know? So where do we get off? We don't. We are on this constant stream of idea. The thinking behind in masonry is quite interesting. The idea, when you pull back from it, is that if we listen, if we experience, if we study and contemplate, if we read, if we listen, then exposure to profound thought, exposure to noble people, will draw those aspects, those characteristics out of our character. Well, it is, in a way, schooling. It's like the mentor taking a boy in hand and saying, look, if you follow this, I think you have the potential for greatness. If you apply yourself, do you know you're very good at that? So a boy stops walking around feeling either inadequate or arrogant, which is what boys often tend to do, and starts to gain a realistic sense, not only of himself, but of the obligations of moving and navigating through life. For private schooling, here in Canada, what we call private schooling, that's something that is often what parents are hoping to achieve. For the public system, that's a process that is as capricious as it always has been. But the intelligent boy will always search out the intelligent older boy, the intelligent older man, the mentor. And it may be the school crossing guard or a teacher who is not identified as such. But you will find that children will gravitate toward adults that make sense. So if we think that the process of learning has stopped at a certain age, then apart from being a little bit smug, a little bit restrictive. We're beings who are in a constant state of learning and awareness. The goals that were promised, the pot of gold at the end of this rainbow, is contentment, is happiness, not jumping up in town cheerleading happy, not a ballpark Frank and a baseball game happy, contentment, being able to rise above the dust. We live in a world where the suffering of other people, the mistakes of other people, is paraded in front of us through the media to sell the media, but it's relabeled as entertainment. Ideas are portrayed in a distorted fashion to make us more susceptible. That's called propaganda. If you're on the bad side, if you're on the good side, it's called information. It's been going on for a long, long time. First World War kind of stuff. Governments finished the wars, and governments realized, oh my goodness, we can manipulate, we can influence entire populations. And ever since, well, you know, how much of a stride was it from that kind of realization to the ridiculous telemarketing that goes on today? We apply, we mock ourselves in this kind of an economic, socioeconomic climate. We mock ourselves. We have a rising number of disadvantaged and poor people, and we have an incredible group of people who are in control of the majority of wealth in the world with no right to that. So we have the end of these social experiments coming around us. We see that we are unable to justify, even in our own minds, the obscene amounts of wealth that are not really benefiting people who need it. So we've got a problem with redistribution. This is going to make us open our textbooks, Hegel, Marx, Keynes. We're going to be looking at these models of economic theory. Economics is what it is. Is it fact? No. It's theory. And so when we come along thinking that any economic model can predict, you listen to the economists. They don't seem to claim that they're able to predict very much. They're always struggling to be descriptive. It's a very complicated world that we live in. So we can't. Do we need them? Yeah. How do they fit in? That depends. I think today we're going to you're going to enjoy the program. I apologize. I start the program talk du jour is about the secret of it, asking you to take the secret of masonry from me. Now, this is we're coming up to what are we coming up to? This past week we've just passed we're coming up to St. Patrick's Day is coming up on the 17th. That was also the day, by the way. That was also the day that the Bolshoi was granted permission to perform. This was Catherine II. Catherine granted the prosecutor, Yurusov, the privilege to maintain the theater performances of all kinds. And so it's, of course, you know the Bolshoi, very influential, very famous, very painful. You know, it's not like a happy place. It's intense, very, very intense. Soon, for those of you who are so inclined, we've got Susan Summers talking to us at the Sankey Lecture. That's coming up on the 22nd of March, not too far away. And she's going to be talking on a specific character in the history, influential in the history of Freemasonry. So I think you'll like it if you can get there for the day. The program starts at 3. A drive to Niagara. Well, let's say that it's the cherry blossoms may not be out in 2 weeks, probably because the ground around us here is frozen 60 feet down. But hope springs eternal. The spring pops back, and if I may have the pleasure of seeing you there, I'd welcome the opportunity to shake a hand or two. Now, back to the bleakness of the topics here. I rely, on a particular source of quotation to accessorize the program. So here I'm talking today about a fellow named Thucydides, and he was a historian, did the history of the Peloponnesian Wars, but he was an Athenian historian and political philosopher, and he happened to be a general in Greece. And we have the benefit of some of his thoughts. He lived in the period 463-95 BC, and in his history of the Peloponnesian War recounts the 5th century BC war between Sparta and Athens in 411 BC. But he was known as the father of scientific history because of his strict standards of evidence gathering and analysis of cause and effect. So we have to have a respect for the man. Up until then, there's in different parts of the world, history was treated differently. What Thucydides did was to objectify it. Instead of saying history is a Muslim history was talking about all things going on, reflecting and reinforcing the values of the Muslim faith, the teachings of the Prophet, peace be with him. And we find that what Thucydides did was start to explore what had actually happened and starting to describe it. Up until then, you see, he was doing this after the war of between Sparta and Athens. I think about 100 years, wasn't it? No, maybe less. Only there was nothing written down. So he went to the places where the battles had taken place and talked with people and got as much information as he could, local, the anecdotes, things that had been passed down about where things had happened and what had happened. And he wrote it down. And he began to travel all over Greece and compile that information. Today, it gives us an account, as accurate an account as we possibly can, of what was happening in the Peloponnesia, where these battles were held. Now, is it verbatim? Well, who's to say anything that we hear about a battlefield is verbatim? It's all impressionist. Yeah? It is all. So he was also called the father of the school of political realism, and that views the relations between nations based on might rather than right. Right? His text is still studied in advanced military colleges worldwide. Advanced military colleges. So, more generally, though, Thucydides showed an interest in developing an understanding of human nature to explain behavior in such crisis. What was our behavior like in reaction to a plague or a massacre or a civil war? Many people know very little about the life of Thucydides. The most reliable comes from his own history, and it talks about his nationality, his parents, and where he grew up, he talks tells us that he fought in the war and he contracted the plague and was exiled by the democracy. Now, interesting, you could be exiled for all kinds of things that are hard for us to follow the logic. But he says here, just a quote to tell you a little bit about the man. I lived through the whole of it, being of an age to comprehend events and giving my attention to them in order to know the exact truth about them. See, he was ordering what happened. So it wasn't like everything happened all at once. Some things happened first and influenced outcomes that influenced the things that happened afterwards. So we start to see that this was a thinking man. It was also my fate to be in exile from my country for 20 years after my command at Amphipolis. He was exiled because he was getting seen to be getting too beyond the control of the democracy. And more especially with the Peloponnesians, by reason of my exile, I had leisure to observe affairs somewhat particularly. He used those 20 years to do something. Hand him lemons, he made lemonade. So do we have enough to work with here? I think you'll find we do more than enough. He's a captivating thinker. He's a man of reason, a man of distinct capability. I think you'll find that his thinking most evident in some of the quotes that have come down to us. He says, right, as the world goes, is only in question between equals in power. I'm sorry we haven't simplified this so that it's this simple soundbite. This is a thinking man. It is a general rule of human nature that people despise those who treat them well and look up to those who make no concessions. The cause of all these evils was the lust for power arising from greed and ambition. And from these passions proceeded the violence of parties once engaged in contention. Hard to believe. Indeed, men too often take upon themselves in the prosecution of their revenge to set the example of doing away with those general laws to which all can look for salvation. The state that separates its scholars from its warriors will have its thinking done by cowards and its fighting by fools. The nation that will insist upon drawing a broad line of demarcation between the fighting man and the thinking man is liable to find its fighting done by fools and its thinking by cowards. He says, it is the habit of mankind to entrust to careless hope what they long for and to use sovereign reason to thrust aside what they do not desire. It's you can see this. This is not a man that would fit in easily. He's not a man that's going to be walk through life unnoticed. And when you do that, as any of you know, when you start to make change, you become a target. You risk a great deal. The masses are not. Have not changed. They are ruthless. They are the court. Just like the 700 jurors who sentenced Plato, who found him guilty. Yeah, 700. That's the approximation. It was chaos. Fights were breaking out. Arguments. There was no order. It's very doubtful that even Plato was even heard in trying to defend himself. My lesson from the past is about Plato. 11 years after his death, Athenians realized what they had lost, what they had done, and began rebuilding monuments to the man. Amazing. Amazing that thinking is that dangerous, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So come today and listen to what I have for you. We're going to, of course, we're going to talk a little bit about what can be explained within the teachings of craft masonry. We become the as we progress here in masonry. One of the secrets I want you to learn about. Take this away. We progress. And we become like, it's like a relationship of a musician to his art. We progress so that we go from learning to hit the notes honestly, you know, Thelonious Monk type of honesty, not fishing for the note, but hitting it in the middle. That's a different kind of honesty. You ever notice how some singers... Oh, they're wonderful singers, but they always fish for the note. Their voice either has to climb for it or go down for it because they miss the note. Now, you want to hear honest voice? Listen to Ella Fitzgerald. Listen to opera singers because that's what they're trained to do. So that's the point I'm making here. Now, as we progress, I mean, Masonically, we are the musician. And we learn we practice. And we learn the notes, and we learn the phrasing, and we learn the context, the texture of the, how to texture the music so that we can draw softness and emotion from those notes. Now, think about it. That's what masonry does for us. Can you live without it? Yeah, you can. But if you have that capacity, it's like the you out there who appreciates a certain je ne sais quoi in something, whether it's a glass of wine or whether it's a form of music or a type of poetry or literature or a particular period of history. If you notice that difference, you notice that you can how nice it feels, how good it feels when you connect with somebody that's like-minded. And you also appreciate the exchange, the value of an exchange of ideas, perspectives. And you walk away both mutually having benefited from the encounter and probably looking forward to the next one. Well, masonry is like that. You have, once if you notice that at the start isn't of importance, it will be pointed out. These processes will be pointed out to you if you're fortunate. It's the operationalizing of this metaphysical process of becoming a better person, making a good man better. Well, I'm a good boy now. I wasn't as good. I've always been really good. But now I'm better because I get to dress up and I have this membership card. I mock myself, not you. All of you are perfect in every way. I'm the imperfect one. It's when you begin, somebody whispers, or you begin to sense it. You pick it up for yourself. Read these principles, but tell us, what does it say to you? What does it mean? What do these things mean? It's not just square and compasses, a little pet peeve there. It's not that we describe them or describe the history of them or what they look like. I'm always wondering, what is it that they mean? You know? And is the meaning the same in every context? No, of course you've heard, you know, that's no. What's their intention and what effect does it have? Well, the great big mass of 3.5 million Masons around the planet, what are we, about half a percent of the world population? Okay. Or less. It's like we have to think of ourselves differently. in this context. So we begin to observe things, and then if you're an operative or a speculative Mason, you're part of threads that began a great long time ago. Remember now, you're listening to an ancient. I liked the original local traditions. I got them. They make sense. This stuff that spun out of lodges all over the place around me makes little sense and it's not that it doesn't make sense. That means it shouldn't matter to you. Of course it should matter to you, but it's going to disappear when you're gone. Likely, because you've come up with the local traditions that replaced something else. Well, what else did they replace? Aha. Get your historians out to start to examine. And most of this isn't written down. That's why it's a vanishing act. These local traditions come and they go. So, a good friend has said that this has taught me repeatedly, this too shall pass. And it always does. I guess I gravitate, like a lot of you, toward things that have some degree of permanence and predictability about them. Even in a changing world, there's some things that I can count on, some things that are authentic. The processes of masonry, they can be stretched and modified to fit a particular culture, but they remain essentially consistent and familiar over the course of time. Even though our language changes, and we hear belly aching about the ritual being modified a bit, so that the meaning is always clear and consistent. Thank you very much, by the way, for those who happen to do that. It's like the belly aching has always been part of our order. So have the way ancients and moderns have operative and speculative masons. There are those who roll up their sleeves because that's what they do. That's the way they see the world, and that's their purpose and contribution. And may the Creator bless them. And there are the thinkers also in the room that wonder and ponder and search for meaning. And they notice things. And may the Creator bless them. Our order is an amalgam. It's like that new metal that comes from pulling two essential metals together. We're the bronze. We're the bronze. You can start off with copper, and you can start off with tin. You can start off with iron ore, but when you add certain ingredients and watch the effect, then you start to improve, don't you? Of course you do. So, are we brass or are we bronze? Those are the complementarities and the antagonists within Freemasonry. And I don't mean antagonists in terms of quarrelsomeness. I mean it in terms of electrolytes, cations and anions. You know, positive, negative. Positive being what? Potassium. Negative charge being what? Chlorides in this. Okay. So that kind of antagonism. Is that, are you thinking like you're talking about a punch in the nose kind of? Come on. That's boyish stuff. Oh, no, no, no. Antagonists. What's going on with your brain chemistry? You know, how do you describe these processes unless you use words that have some meaning to us? So, those kind of give and take create balance. It's a molecular thing in my mind. You know, we have these neutrons and electrons. What are they doing? You know, protons, what are they doing? They have that dynamic process that keeps them functioning. And that's what I think happens in Masonic lodges. It's not uniformity. There's not just one molecule throughout a lodge. And so it is stronger and better for that. Now, I apologize for taunting anyone out there who feels a Mason is a member of a menacing cult. I apologize to you if you feel that way. I need to speak with you about trust. This isn't cultish. Cultish has a malevolent odor to it. This is a group vulnerable to that type of finger pointing and comment, who a group that feels very bad that somebody would consider Masonry as a menace. But in a sense, they respect that you have that opinion. And perhaps it redoubles their commitment to prove to the world around them that they are beneficial, that they are not interested at all in control. They don't have a particular philosophy they want to imprint on the rest of the world. Their function is to inspire, and they need acts, and they use great ideas and significant people as sources of inspiration. Yes, they cross lines. Yes, they don't see color. Yes, they don't see religious barriers. They search for that oneness of faith that all men agree upon. So, if that's the case, you and I need to talk about some of the work of one of the world's foremost mythologists who isn't with us any longer, John Joseph Campbell. So we'll get into Campbell's work in the future. But for anybody who thinks that Masonry is cultish in nature, it's just not there. It's just not there. What it is a process to try and bring a safer, happier relationship to the world by being who they are. And the interesting part is, take this away. Here's the secret of Masonry. If you watch the behavior of a Mason, that will tell you everything that you need to know. A menacing man will act menacing. He will act in a suspicious way. He will also challenge, by his behavior, misbeliefs. When somebody is saying something that isn't valid, you watch a Freemason and you will see validity in what he does. He may be a bit of a knucklehead. He may not like the same music, or he may actually play cards. I know that would have been a deal breaker for my grandfather. God bless his soul. But all apart from that, you'll see him willing to give a helping hand when people need it. That does not mean that these are little robots. These are human beings with as much baggage and as anybody else, but they've also made a personal commitment to self-improvement. So they make mistakes, but they improve on it. They learn from their errors. So here, take away that secret of Masonry, and also take away this heartfelt apology. Not the variety being mentioned by any one Western culture. I'm not talking about that kind of trust. You know, trust me, just because I'm big and powerful. Though they expound to have great values and high ethics, they act with impunity, don't they? They act with the impunity they despise. And the world suffers the pain of despising them. They could be anyone. They could be anyone. So watch for people that are saying one thing and doing something else. Watch just in terms of what it tells you about the world that we live in. What it tells you. That's what's most important. Nobody's going to be out there browbeating you into accepting another way of thinking. No, that's not the Masonic way. It's nice when you become a member of this organization that you begin to have learn what the Masonic way is. It's devilish because the Masonic way is an attitude of fairness and fair play, an attitude of forgiveness, and thinking about the greater good. And my goodness, over the years, over the centuries, we can see the influence of that thinking all around us, in particular here in this country, the notion of free education. Now, a little bit of social history here, and to end this off, there are three countries in the world that don't pay any kind of benefit for mothers when they're having children. I'm just telling you this while I'm getting the next articles in front of me for you. Do you want to know that throughout those three countries in the world, Papua New Guinea, yeah, I don't know, Oman, go figure, and the United States. Okay, we'll move right on. Three. Ignominious group. Scandinavia and Europe has more appeal. I don't mean the kind of nonsense going on in Greece, where the general attitude is you screw your own country by not paying your fair share of tax. Fair share. $72 billion or $73 billion owed to their government, and they're on the edge of bankruptcy. Oy, that's what I'm saying here. Oy. So I want to talk to you a little bit about complaints. Wine, oh dear. Wine, wine, wine. But look at this through the eyes of Epicureanism, yeah? Okay? Just as a lens, we change the color of the glasses that we wear and see what it tells us. Now, Epicureanism is a system of philosophy. We've talked about this before on the show. And it's based on the teachings of the ancient Greek philosopher Epicurus, of course. He started this a little later, about 307 BC. This guy was known as an atomic materialist. Atomism, right? Now, atomism is a natural philosophy that developed in several ancient traditions. The atomists theorized that nature consisted of two principles, two fundamentals, atom and void. Atom and the space in between them. Eh? Physicists love this. Unlike their modern scientific namesake in atomic theory, philosophical atoms come in an infinite variety of shapes and sizes, each indestructible, immutable, and surrounded by a void where they collide with the others and are hooked together, forming a cluster. This is just brilliant, isn't it? Clusters of different shapes and arrangements and positions give rise to various macroscopic substances in the world. The particles of chemical matter for which chemists and other natural philosophers of the early 19th century found experimental evidence were thought to be indivisible and therefore were given the name atom, long used by the atomist philosophy. So, do you see where it started? The 20th century atoms of the chemists were found to be composed of even smaller entities, electrons, neutrons, and protons. And experiments showed that the protons and neutrons were made up of quarks. Yeah. So, enough of that. We'll go on. Epicureanism, that's what we're here to talk about. But he was an atomic materialist in the philosophical sense of the term. And this led, his materialism led to a general attack on superstition and divine intervention. Now remember, when we were talking, we would be talking, sitting out looking at the stars, and we see a shooting star. Why did that happen? Well, at the time, the answer was to go to the accepted scripture for the answer. Oh, well, that was God's will. Really? Well, we find now you can accept that. You can say big picture, it's all part of the creator's will. Or we can say, well, there's a chunk of something floating around up there, and as it hits the atmosphere, you know, da-da-da-da, okay? So this is a guy back, think about this, 4th century, you know, this would be 2nd century, right? I'm thinking backwards here, B.C., 307. He started to attack these ideas and divine intervention. So, oh, why did that person die like that? Oh, it was, you know, the creator's will. You know, but Epicurus believed that what he called pleasure is the greatest good. But the way to attain such pleasure is to live modestly, and to gain knowledge of the workings of the world and the limits of one's desires. How does the world work? Think about it. How does it work? How does the world handle conflict? How does the world handle famine? How does it handle shortage? How does it handle greed? How does it handle hubris? It's there. So he's saying, in order to attain such pleasure, right, the greatest good requires a modest life and a knowledge of how the world works and the limits of one's desires. This, if you do this, this helps a man generically, when I talk here. This led one to attain a state of tranquility. The term you'll hear about this is ataraxia, okay? Ataraxia. And freedom. We become tranquil and there's a freedom from fear, as well as an absence of bodily pain. Aponia in Greek. So the combination of these two states is supposed to constitute happiness in its highest form. Never thought of that. Although Epicureanism is a form of hedonism, insofar as it declares pleasure to be the sole intrinsic good, hedonism, its conception of absence of pain as the greatest pleasure and its advocacy of a simple life makes it different from hedonism, as it's commonly understood. This really does fly in the face of the nouveau riche, doesn't it? The conspicuous display of consumption. I have wealth, so I have to display it. If you look at these kind of processes and events in a fit with a sense of understanding the truth or the philosophy of what's happening around us, you see that it's not very legitimate, is it? It doesn't make a person any different because they're, or better because they have wealth and can buy a Maserati. Yeah, I would like a Maserati, but I wouldn't like what it says about me. Sorry. So Epicureanism was originally a challenge to Platonism. Remember, we talked about Platonism and nominalism, right? And this is the philosophy of Plato. It talks about the third realm, distinct from the sensible external world and the internal world of consciousness, right? So if things existed in the mind, they were real in the Platonism sense of the term. And it's the opposite of nominalism. Remember? Nominalism, if it doesn't exist in time and space, it doesn't exist. So this confronted Platonism. Yeah. So that's the interesting part of Epicureanism. Now, we're talking about achieving the highest forms of pleasure, tranquility and a freedom of fear, and how to get there. It was originally a challenge, but it later became the main opponent of Stoicism. Remember, we talked about this a little bit. The Stoics taught that destructive emotions resulted from errors in judgment, and that a sage or a person of moral and intellectual perfection would not suffer such emotions. So to not have experienced the experience of destructive emotions, we stop making errors in judgment. Stoics then concern themselves with the active relationship between a cosmic determinism and human freedom. And so this was a belief that it is virtuous to maintain a will that is in accord with nature. So we have to begin to understand the workings of nature. And because of this, the Stoics told us that philosophy, this was a philosophy as a way of life. And they thought that the best indication of an individual's philosophy was not what a person said, but how they behaved. Hear, hear. Later, you've heard me talk about Seneca and Epictetus. They were Stoics. They espoused this view of the world. Virtue is sufficient for happiness. A sage is immune to misfortune. So this belief is similar to the meaning of the phrase Stoic calm. Okay? So the Stoics, so now you see that this Epicureans were at odds with this Stoic view of the world. Okay? They were saying that tranquility can and pleasure can be achieved by living modestly. Right? Here we're saying that you can live without, that we can avoid the destructive emotions that result from errors in judgment by knowing that that's what the source of these ill feelings is about. So here we're going to, anyway, we have the two of them. So I want you to look at this or listen to this small piece on the complaint about late lectures. This came from 1819. And I want you to listen to it with the view of an Epicurean. Remember? Okay. So think about the Epicurean, the modest view, a knowledge, a striving to gain a knowledge of the workings of the world and to limit our desires, like saying, be happy with what we have, be able to enjoy. There's no other place I'd rather be than right here, right now. It's also like saying, you know, if you're thinking about those temporal senses, the past, present, and future, that there is only a present, that we only live in the moment, and that to revel in that, not to be caught up wishing it was the way it was before, because before is gone. Before no longer exists except in our minds. What we experience today in order to achieve this contentment is to accept that where I am and what's going on around me is as good as it is for me today, and that I am content with this. That's the added part. I am content with this. The making of regular lodges responsible for what was taught in the Lodge of Instruction was no sooner settled then the matter of a system of instruction came up again. This is right after, remember, this is following the Lodge of Promulgation, the mergers, if you will, a reconciliation of ancients and moderns. On the 2nd of June of 1819, Peter Gilkes proposed in Grand Lodge that a committee be appointed to investigate the manner in which the lectures of masonry are now worked. Interesting to think about that, some uniformity. I think it's important. I used to think that I understand and appreciate that some lodges are continuing on with ritual that predates Grand Lodge. I appreciate that because it's a curiosity. But I also appreciate the benefit of this kind of uniformity. It's almost like, I don't know if it's a guarantee, it's almost like an opportunity. Can it be better? Yeah, probably. But this is like a solid base for masonry. So we saw this being revisited to set a committee to investigate the manner in which the lectures were worked. So they took a look at, they started by looking at going out and surveying, seeing how things were going. This proposal was not carried. The probable reason for such a proposal in Grand Lodge is shown in complaints contained in two memorials to the Board of General Purpose about the same time. They were in relation to a new and unauthorized lecture being worked in General Lodges of Instruction by Philip Broadfoot, Thomas Slattery, and James McAvoy, in which, among other things, subjects which belong to one degree are introduced into others. That could be a problem. The memorial asked the board to put a stop to such proceedings. The complaints were investigated, and the board reported back on the 1st of September 1918 that the board are of the opinion that the charges stated in the said memorials are not made out, although they must at the same time state their deliberate judgment that no individuals have any right to make a new lecture and promulgate the same to the craft as authorized without receiving the authority of the Grand Master or Grand Lodge for such a lecture. So the boys were, some of them were taking liberties, huh? But they also feel that the individuals complained of have no improper motives. Hear, hear. Look for the best. No improper motives. What do you mean? We were just trying to... And they were believed. No. These men were judges. The judgment of a Mason is when you have, you can, in your mind, see that you're justified in doing something, and you control that desire, you control that emotion, and you act otherwise. It's where forgiveness comes from. It's easier to forgive an enemy than it is to forgive a friend. Philip Broadfoot and Thomas Satterley were leading members of the Stability Lodge of Instruction, which they had established in December of 1817. They had both been members of the Lodge of Reconciliation, although they were not appointed to fill vacancies until December of 1814, and by which time, or very shortly after, it was probable that Reverend Samuel Heming, its master, was given up his work on lectures, and the task had been transferred to William Williams. For later records of the Stability Lodge of Instruction, we know that the lecture in the first degree, which they consistently worked, was compiled by Heming. It seems likely that if other lectures were compiled, as the complaint implies, they were dropped as a result of the board's comments, for the records of Stability Lodge show that through the 1820s, the lecture in the first degree was the only one worked. The Duke of Sussex was not present at the September meeting at which this report of the board was presented, although several were, including Heming, who might have been aware of the situation. If measures were adopted to establish officially sanctioned lectures, the semi-official system of the Grand Steward's Lodge might have to be re-examined, with further bickering of the sort that had occurred in the time tried to settle the ritual only 5 years before. My goodness, we don't want that. The day was saved by a resolution being carried that it was unnecessary to adopt the recommendation of the board on sanctioned lectures, as the motion for a committee had been negatived at the previous Grand Lodge. This reminds me of the time when grammar, when, you know, it's the 18th century, when Johnson was writing his dictionaries, where it was thought that as long as you understood the meaning of the word, it didn't matter how it was spelled. You know, good times. Those who felt that a formally sanctioned system was the best way of achieving complete uniformity made a further attempt at the next quarterly communication on the 1st of December 1819. They were, however, unsuccessful in seeking to restore the board's recommendation for sanctioned lectures. The Grand Master was in the chair at this December meeting, and he made a pronouncement on the subject which was quite uncharacteristic of his known wish for complete uniformity, but which diplomatically reflected the obvious feeling of the majority. He addressed the brethren on the subject of the lectures when he stated that it was his opinion that so long as the master of any lodge observed exactly the landmarks of the craft, he was at liberty to give the lectures of the language best suited to the character of the lodge over which he presided. That, however, no person was permitted to practice as an itinerant lecturer to other lodges, which was decidedly against the rules and regulations of the craft, and that brethren of different lodges convening themselves for the purpose of a lecture, without a regular warrant or other sanction from the Grand Master, were likewise guilty of dereliction of their duty toward the Grand Lodge, and which, of course, if known, would be noticed and proceeded against accordingly. There. Brethren with different lodges meeting it to work a lecture is a fair description of a general lodge of instruction. And shows, the basic illustrations and symbolism contained in the general accepted lectures at the time. This pronouncement has been interpreted, particularly when read in later years, with the present Rule 155, to mean that the ritual could be worked using any words of the master's discretion. When it is considered that the Duke had gone to some trouble a few years before to have certain parts of the ceremonies approved in detail, obligations being a particular example, and with his known efforts for a high degree of uniformity, I think such complete freedom puts too wide an interpretation on the Duke's words. It is, of course, interest to note that Philip Broadfoot was a member of the Board of General Purpose, which dealt with the 1818 revisions, and that Thomas Satterley was a member in the year that the complaints were dealt with. Yet their Stability Lodge of Instruction does not appear to have given notice to Grand Secretary in terms of the 1818 rule, for its name is not in the register. There. Different. That's our history. That was then. That was then. So now remember, we have a lot of baggage, a lot of history on our shoulders that they didn't have in 1818. And so we see things through a different lens, a different way of looking at it, a different prism, if you want. And we put what was happening then. That was very real. But now you and I can put that into context where we can see, and in a sense, prove to ourselves whether they were right or wrong. Isn't that an interesting concept to put out in a discussion around Masonic values? What was the outcome or the effect of this kind of thinking? Uniformity. Are we feeling that we're all in harness intellectually? Or are we thinking that what they created was a platform, a platform of some uniformity and predictability on which to build greater ideas? So they didn't build this structure on moving sands. Interesting use of the metaphor. And we today function. Particularly, I think, assuming that we have benefited from this uniformity. And what they didn't see was, of course, the question hidden inside the task that they were resolving. They didn't see the question of motivation. Maybe they did. Maybe they looked around Lodge and saw that some were disinterested and recognized, as Albert Pike did, that what we gain depends on our own ability. This isn't a doctrine that's going to make any person any different. It's not imposed. It's intrinsic. The change comes from within. And if you're just a daffy, happy guy, that's, you know, bless your heart. If you're a contemplative fellow, bless your heart. If all you can do is follow the pack, you're not going to cause any harm. I hope. So what's the Epicurean in you see? What do you hear? Modesty? An understanding of the workings of the world and the limit of one's desires. I hope you'll come back and listen to this. That's it. That's all I've got, you know. I have to say that we're looking forward to some of the things coming up in the spring around masonry. And I look forward to speaking with you. Thank you so very much for your support. I hope that this has given you a little bit of insight about our roots and about the thinking at the time that's led and contributed to the way that masonry has worked today. Always, I think the settling point is on the shoulders of each one of us, that what we have in common is that we are within a brotherhood, a fraternal order. But what we take from it is not as uniform. It varies as much as our curiosity. You may be very invested in ritual. That other fellow is invested in mythology. That other fellow in symbolism. And all of that, and so much more. That fellow that wants to commit acts of Masonic kindness. The person that wants to develop charity so that it's not done to keep people humble, but to assist people who are in need. All of this and so much more makes up the Masonic order. I'm very grateful that you were able to join this morning. I hope we brought the message to that you needed to hear or that you found interesting or provocative. Send me a line if the email address, MasonicCompanion@gmail.com. And I look forward to 1C, Masonic Co., remember, 1C between them. I look forward to being with you next week. Remember, we've got a Friday the 13th coming up. I see the second one. We had one in February. And are you superstitious? See this as a terribly awful thing, or is this something that is part of that pre-Christian notion of luck? How did 13 become associated with being an unlucky number? It's all there in history. I'm going to leave you with a little bit of Wes Montgomery. He would have celebrated, had he been alive, he would have celebrated his 90th birthday this week. This is from Belgium. In 1965, this is when cars were easily, you could get 2 or 3 tons of car, Detroit steel, big fins, huge, cumbersome bumpers. If you hit anything, there was a likelihood you'd have went through it. But those steel dashes, they were just being replaced by a little bit of padding. I wouldn't exactly call it impact absorbing. Seat belts were still optional. And most cars still had AM radios. Wes Montgomery. Enjoy. I'll see you real soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.